Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 6, 2025. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a front page article from the Republic entitled Following the Money about Pandemic Relief Funds, and then we'll move on to another top story over legal action against a new Arizona law. So again, the first article, which is front page, is entitled Following the Money. The subtitle is Arizona Struggles to Recoup $32 Million in Questionable Pandemic Relief Spending by Summer Camps. This is by Mary Jo Pitzel. Summer Camp 2022 was a great time for Camp Grace, a sprawling property amid the pine trees and mountains of eastern Arizona. The guest cottages at the camp in Lakeside were renovated, four new camper cottages were built, a basketball court and a ninja course were added, and staffers enjoyed a stay at a luxury resort in Phoenix. All of this is courtesy of a $1.3 million federal grant intended to address students' learning loss due to disruption caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. But those great times appear poised to be coming to an end. Budget officials in Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs' office have been trying to claw back all but $3,200 of that $1.3 million, plus all of a $280,000 grant awarded in 2023. Hobbs' office said the camp's expenses either didn't comply with federal rules or lacked required documentation, a finding that Camp Grace strongly rejects. Camp Grace is not the only beneficiary facing scrutiny for its expenditures in the Arizona On Track summer camp program. Then-Governor Doug Ducey, a Republican, created the program in his last year in office, touting it would be more flexible than any other program funded by state or federal grant dollars. One recipient used the grant to buy a $185,000 flight simulator. Another funded trips to Top Golf. Others lacked formal accounting systems for tracking expenses. In one case, a recipient provided handwritten notes to document expenditures. So far, none of the estimated $32 million in federal grant dollars that the budget office has identified as improperly spent by 63 of the 164 grant recipients has been recouped. Based on the replies from two of the first camp sponsors to be fully audited, clawing back the dollars will be difficult. In 2022, Arizona was awarded $88 million in federal pandemic relief dollars for summer learning programs. Of that, $75 million went to 164 grant recipients, with the remainder used to pay 11 vendors to manage the grants. Keeping with the flexibility that Ducey's office promoted, the money was awarded without any check on whether the expenditures fit with federal guidelines. That was a red flag, according to budget officials who came on board when Hobbs succeeded Ducey in early 2023. They argue that advancing the grant money, rather than using it to reimburse allowable expenses, violated federal guidelines and led to wasteful spending. They also questioned other practices as they started the mandatory exercise of closing out the grants in the summer of 2024, nearly 2 years after the money was spent. That clash of administrative philosophy from two different gubernatorial offices has amounted to a drawn-out and contentious effort to recoup $32 million that could be used to fund similar programs in the coming year. Several of the grant recipients have been referred to the Arizona Attorney General's Office and the State Auditor General's Office for investigation. The Attorney General's Office acknowledged it had received referrals, but would not comment on whether investigations were underway. The Auditor General did not return several calls for comment. Christian Slater, a spokesman for Hobbs' office, said the total absence of accountability led to improper spending. It's no wonder the program only served approximately 88,608 of the 250,000 children that were meant to participate, he said, citing estimates from the budget office on how many children benefited from the 2022 camps. But State Representative Matt Gress, who served as Ducey's budget director at the time, questioned why it was only in 2024 that the Hobbs administration took a look at expenditures made in 2022. "Seems a little late," said Gress, a Phoenix Republican. "If there were problems with the grants, and he maintains there were none, no one from the Hobbs administration reached out to him for guidance," Gress said. "It seems like this is just another example of the Hobbs administration blaming the Ducey administration," he said. State alleges improper spending, conflicts of interest. The red flag started waving in mid-2024 when the governor's Office of Strategic Planning and Budgeting began to wrap up the mandatory reports on the 164 grant recipients. They could not access, much less locate, the online portal that contained the financial information needed to close out the federal grants, staffers said. There was no information for the last 4 months of 2022 from the vendors who oversaw the grants, they said. They reached out to the camp directors for documentation and dug through other files to search for proof of how the money was spent. Camp Grace was an early head-turner. The White Mountains retreat could not provide documents to back up its expenditures over two summers, many of which were questionable, not allowed without prior written approval or outright not permitted by federal rules, according to the state's November 2024 letter seeking reimbursement of $1.6 million spent over two summers. The letter faulted the camp and its founder and director, Jennifer Brimhall, for numerous violations, including equipment purchases in 2022 that included a tractor, golf carts, equipment trailers, and a bus for a total of $62,000. All lacked written pre-approval, the letter stated. The bus was in off-site storage, although budget office auditors last year could not verify its location or condition. Four new camper cottages, renovation of other cabins, $41,000 for a basketball court, and nearly $21,000 for a ninja course. These improvements also lacked written pre-approval and were not necessary and reasonable to conduct a summer camp program during a four-month project period, according to the letter. Conflict of interest by hiring family members at rates that were not reasonable for the services rendered. That included Brimhall's $124,823 salary and $151,423 paid to Annalise Jensen, Brimhall's daughter, who served as program director. Their summer 2022 salaries exceeded market rates for summer camp programming, especially because the camps only ran for 4 months. The camp also hired Brimhall's husband, Ian, an orthopedic surgeon, as the camp's medical director. There was no requirement for the camps to have such a position. Camp Grace also hired a company Ian Brimhall runs to provide horseback rides when another vendor backed out. These expenditures and others, such as nearly $6,000 for staff to stay at the Arizona Grand Resort and Spa in Phoenix, and $800 for an outing to Topgolf in Gilbert, were emblematic of problems with the 2024 grant program, Slater said. The budget office also found issues with 2023 summer camp grants issued under the Hobbs administration. Although these grants were smaller and issued only as reimbursements, the closeout process found similar problems with documenting how the money was spent. Camp Grace blames former accountant, different political agenda. Camp Grace submitted a defiant response in December, defending its expenditures and noting they were approved by the previous Ducey administration. In its letter to the governor's budget office, an attorney for the camp, suggested that perhaps a different political agenda led to an about-face on whether the expenditures were proper. The letter noted the high marks the camp summer programs received from attendees and from the outside groups hired to evaluate the summer learning efforts. Camp Grace was identified as one of the bright spots in the 2022 program and was in the top 10 of camps in terms of performance, according to the Arizona On Track final report. It showed high performance on the five goals identified for the camps: connection, creating a growth mindset, self-efficacy, anticipation for the coming school year, and experience. Camp Grace blamed its former accounting firm, Klaus and Hall, for malfeasance. It charged the Gilbert firm did not provide required reports, didn't return the camp's records so operators could prove the validity of their expenditures, and failed to prepare tax reports. Camp officers filed a complaint with the State Board of Accountancy, which resulted in an April 2024 settlement over issues stemming from the firm's handling of Camp Grace's 2020 and 2021 tax returns. There was no mention of subsequent tax years. The firm did not return a call seeking comment. Further complicating the camp's ability to comply with the state's demands, its letter noted Brimhall had significant health issues during the budget office's review, which limited her ability to work for long stretches. The camp had a small staff that had to juggle multiple administrative tasks while also working with the hundreds of children who attended the camps, attorney Deborah Verdier wrote on behalf of Camp Grace. Another hurdle was the limited number of vendors in rural Arizona, leading to reliance on related parties for some services, a move that the budget office viewed as a conflict of interest. Camp Grace maintains federal tax law allows such hires, as long as the payment is in line with fair market rates. It concluded by requesting the budget office to withdraw its demand for reimbursement and accept the expenditures as proper. With the issue at a stalemate, the state's attempt to recoup the money will be sent to collections, which are handled by the Office of Attorney General Chris Mays, a Democrat. Meanwhile, grant recipients who have been determined by the budget office to have misspent the money can appeal to the Inspector General of the U.S. Treasury Department. Other grant recipients also on the hook. As of late 2024, the Arizona Science Center was the only other grant recipient fully reviewed by the Governor's Budget Office. It determined the center must return $325,066 of the $4.7 million it received in 2022 and 2023. Among other items, the center spent $24,000 on supplies toward the end of the summer camp or after the grant period ended. They paid all of its janitorial costs with grant money, even though the center serves a wider audience than just children's summer camps, and spent $64,000 on accounting costs without getting approval to do so. After the review, the center asked that any costs disallowed by the budget office be applied to future summer camps, but that was rejected because the grant period had expired. Based on its findings, the budget office said it now considers the center a high-risk grantee. The center, through a spokesperson, said it would comply with the state's demand, but maintained it followed proper procedures in tracking and spending the money. One of the bigger single-item purchases among the 164 camps receiving federal grants came from the Challenger Space Center in Peoria, $185,000 for a flight simulator. While the simulator undoubtedly has educational value, the grant was not intended to pay for long-lasting capital improvements that would be used beyond the duration of a 4-week summer camp, state budget officials said. The $185,000 expenditure was part of the $1.3 million owed back to the state, the budget office wrote in a November letter to the center. It invited the center to provide documentation that would substantiate that its purchases were legitimate. The center, formerly known as the Earth and Space Expedition Center, did not return repeated calls for comment about its use of summer camp dollars. Will Arizona be able to recoup the money? By early 2025, the review process concluded there were issues with 63 of the 164 grant recipients that required either clarification or reimbursement. All were sent letters notifying them of deficiencies identified by the budget office, Slater said. The budget office is still reviewing the remaining 101 grantees. Thus far, efforts to claw back money already spent have been mostly futile. The state did recoup $7.3 million from 24 recipients who voluntarily refunded unspent dollars. In addition, the budget office has identified $9.4 million in other unused dollars. As of mid-March, it has recouped $6.1 million. The work is ongoing. The Attorney General's office said it is still investigating the referral it has received thus far, and the Governor's office review of all grant recipients is ongoing as of mid-March. Slater said he has no idea when the whole federally funded camp issue will wrap up. I don't know if it ever does, he said, of a potential end to the review and refund process. It's been an odyssey. And that article was entitled Following the Money, and that was by Mary Jo Pitzel. Our next top story from Sunday's paper is entitled Immigrant Group Sues Over New Arizona Law, with the subtitle, Says Voters Were Misled on Enforcement Funding. This is by Paula Soria and David Uoa Jr. Living United for Change in Arizona, LUCHA, filed a lawsuit against the state of Arizona to dismantle the Secure the Border Act, which voters passed through Proposition 314 in November, arguing that the legislature deceived Arizona voters when they failed to identify a funding source to enforce the law. On April 2nd, during a news conference outside the Superior Court of Arizona, LUCHA leadership said the law was unconstitutional and announced their plans to combat the legislation they have frequently criticized as being anti-immigrant. We are here to fight back against the rising tide of authoritarianism, Alejandra Gomez, executive director of LUCHA, said during the news conference. We have lived through this before. We remember the trauma of Senate Bill 1070. LUCHA, a nonprofit organization based in Phoenix that advocates for immigrant rights, has been at the helm of the fight against the GOP's anti-immigrant agenda even before Donald Trump retook the White House. In 2024, as the collection of Republican-backed bills that ultimately became Proposition 314 made its way through the Arizona legislature, LUCHA leadership, joined by other prominent civil and immigrant rights activists, spoke out against its passing. The lawsuit, filed early April 2nd, calls for the dismantling of the Secure the Border Act based on three counts: failing to provide a new revenue source for enforcement, attempting to define probable cause, a power belonging only to the judicial branch, and adhering the law's enforcement to the outcome of the similar Texas's Senate Bill 4. Passed by 63% of Arizona voters during the 2024 election, Proposition 314 created a series of new state crimes that directly impact immigrants living and entering Arizona, including the sale of fentanyl resulting in death, the use of false information when applying for government benefits, and, as a result, the required use of E-Verify. But the change that sparked the most criticism was the criminalization of unauthorized border crossings, allowing state officials to arrest and deport individuals they suspect of doing so. Activists and critics have said that this move mimics the former 2010 Senate Bill 1070 law, also referred to as the Show Me Your Papers law, suggesting that the provision can lead to civil rights abuse and racial profiling. Martin Hernandez, an organizer with the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 99 and plaintiff in the lawsuit, said during the news conference that he and his union were ready to stand with Lucha in their fight against Proposition 314. Let me be clear. This law will not make anyone safer. If the people in our neighborhoods are too afraid to call the police, that makes everyone less safe, Hernandez said. State Senate Minority Leader Priya Sundaresan also spoke in support of the lawsuit, saying that when political extremist agendas override basic human rights, it's up to all of us to push back. In an interview with La Voz, the Arizona Republic, prior to the filing of the suit, Gomez said Proposition 314 fuels the intentions carried by the Trump administration to conduct massive deportations. In essence, it is the gateway to allow the erosion of constitutional rights that community members have of due process, Gomez said. It puts Arizona back into the center stage of the long standing that we have had in Arizona being a test ground for really egregious bills. Three-pronged lawsuit. James Barton, the lawyer representing Lucha in the lawsuit, said Proposition 314 is plainly unconstitutional on three counts. According to court documents obtained by the Republic, Lucha claims the law violates the revenue source rule of the Arizona Constitution, which mandates that proposed initiatives and referendums list funding sources, which GOP sponsors and backers did not address. Citing a fiscal note from the Joint Legislative Budget Committee dated May 2024, Barton said the enforcement of the law would not only result in increased spending for law enforcement across the state, but also lead to a decline in immigration, which would reduce state and local tax collections. The second count states that the law violates the separation of powers clause of the Arizona Constitution when, via the approval of this law, the legislature tried to define probable cause, a power delegated to the judicial branch. The third count, per court documents, calls on the delegation of lawmaking powers to the Texas state legislature via the Senate Bill 4 clause of Proposition 314. Parts of the Secure the Border Act are heavily dependent on the court's determination to uphold Texas's Senate Bill 4, a law similar to Arizona's. The U.S. Justice Department challenged the Texas law during the Biden administration and has been stuck in the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ever since. Barton said delegating powers to another state legislature is unconstitutional. Draconian bills. Gomez said legislation like Proposition 314 and 13 other anti-immigrant bills being debated at the Arizona legislature are putting Arizona back into the spotlight for its draconian bills. Bills mentioned by Lucha include Senate Bill 1164, which would require state law enforcement agencies to cooperate with ICE, and Senate Bill 1111, which would create a bounty system for the arrest and eventual deportation of undocumented immigrants. Other bills that would help further Trump's agenda are Senate Bill 1088, which would mandate all public entities and their independent contractors to comply with all federal laws, rules, regulations, or orders that relate to immigration and deportation, with penalties for entities and contractors who don't comply. House Bill 2099, which requires local government cooperation with federal immigrant authorities, including compelling the governor and state attorney general to cooperate. Sundaresan said the Secure the Border Act is about control, fear, terror, and punishment, adding that it was just the tip of the iceberg of the MAGA agenda at the Arizona legislature. Proposition 314, or any of these other bills we see in this session, are not just a single policy. They are a pattern. It is a pattern of coordinated extremist agenda to bring Trump's mass deportation plan to life, and Arizona is being used as a proving ground, Sundaresan said. And that article was entitled, Immigrant Group Sues Over New Arizona Law, and that was by Paula Soria and David Uoa Jr. We're going to move on now to Valley and State News with an article from the archive section of the paper entitled Politics Mixed with a Slab of Prime Rib, with the subtitle Durant's, the iconic Phoenix restaurant that shaped Arizona's political landscape. This is by Ronald J. Hansen and Mary Jo Pitzel. A quarter century ago, Democrats Janet Napolitano and U.S. Representative Ed Pastor wanted to rejuvenate their political party in Arizona and had a plan to do so. After Napolitano left the governor's office 10 years later, her successor, Republican Secretary of State Jan Brewer, wanted to celebrate her own ascent as the state's chief executive. A common, if well-worn, thread connected both events: Durant's Restaurant. The Phoenix institution that closed its doors after 75 years in business on Central Avenue hosted both of them. New owners planned to reopen the restaurant. For decades, Durant served as the unofficial bipartisan quorum call for after-hours bowl sessions, midday power lunches, and sounding board for gossip, game plans, and anything else for the politically connected. Once, the sitting governor and four former governors all reputedly dined at Durant's on the same day and not with each other. It always reminded me of a movie star restaurant, Brewer recalled last week. The Los Angeles native said it was reminiscent of stalwart Hollywood eateries such as the Brown Derby and the Life You Never Lived. It certainly wasn't a place you'd go to if you wanted a private meeting, said Rob Dallagher, a former state Senate staffer and now a lobbyist. You'd always run into people from the Capitol. Durant's signature red wallpaper, its dim lighting and back alley entry added to a charm verging on mystique. It lent a sense of history to a city more often linked to what is new. Durant's opened in July 1950 and was the namesake business of Jack Durant, who arrived in Phoenix after managing the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas. Before he ran the hotel, Durant was a pit boss there for gangster Bugsy Siegel. He memorably described his restaurant this way: "In my humble opinion, Durant's is the finest eating and drinking establishment in the world. It was good enough for John Wayne, Joe DiMaggio, and Clark Gable. But it was Arizona's political class that helped define the restaurant." In 1999, for example, Napolitano and Pastor recruited shopping mall developer Jim Peterson to head the party. They appealed to him at Durant's. "My pitch to him was this: our state is going the wrong direction. I told him we need a two-party state," Napolitano recalled in a 2002 interview just after she won the first of two elections as governor. "At the time, our party was bankrupt of ideas. Jim Peterson changed all that." Barrett Marson, a former state house staffer, remembers watching in 2007 when the then president of the Senate and speaker of the House worked out the parameters of the state budget in the dining room. "It was a hideaway," Marson said, "but also a place to be seen." "A lot of work gets done there," said Steve Mortel, another legislative staffer turned lobbyist. He became a regular when he joined the House staff years ago and has continued, part of a loosely organized group of Wednesday regulars. Patrons could rely on reasonably priced drinks served up by two friendly and attentive bartenders who made the place feel like home, Mortel said. The unusual entry, where in-the-know patrons would walk through the bustling kitchen to get to the dining room and bar, separated the insiders from the outsiders, Marson said. Representative Jeff Weiniger, a Chandler Republican, said he thought he had taken a wrong turn when on his first visit he found himself walking through the kitchen. "I thought I had done something wrong," he said. Others said the kitchen entry ritual evoked a mobster feel, or as Mortel put it, an old-school Goodfellas vibe. Durant's was a lifeline for reporters, too. When the Arizona Republic wanted public reaction to the 1988 impeachment vote against then-Governor Ed Meacham, a Republican, Durant's was one of the places reporters looked. When the Republic highlighted a state law banning alcohol sales on Election Day until the polls closed, The newspaper showed up in 1990 at Durant's to find men sipping Cokes in the afternoon. Not that they were happy about it. "It's an archaic law," one man said. "I think once you vote, you should be able to go down to the bar and maybe they stamp your hand or something and you get a drink," another man told the Republic. If not the proper mix of voting and drinking for everyone, it at least reflected the reality that Durant's was the hub for those that did. Its history with the Republic had a darker chapter from 1976. The day after a bomb detonated under the car of the Republic's investigative reporter Don Bowles, two key figures in the assassination sat in a booth in Durant's to discuss money for the hit. There were more uplifting occasions. In 1998, Durant's participated in Arizona's portion of a national day set aside for restaurants to donate portions of their day's proceeds to charity combating AIDS. Bruce Arony, the general manager, and about 60 staffers down to the dishwashers donated their pay for the day to the cause. They hoped to raise $50,000. They raised $75,000. Across time, party lines, and changing causes, Durant's has served as a seemingly unchanging backdrop. Jennifer Longden went there last year to celebrate her transition from her job as a state lawmaker to spokeswoman for the Arizona Alliance of Community Health Centers. "It was a long, lovely, lazy evening," Longden said. Before the entrees were due to arrive, Longden, who uses a wheelchair, left for the bathroom, which was inaccessible. She was told she could use the restroom at the pizza place nearby, which required her to roll a half block over bumpy terrain. The restaurant owner offered to hold her entree while she was gone. But aside from that, he had nothing to offer to improve the situation. "Nostalgic privilege hurts," Longden said. And that article is entitled "Politics Mixed with a Slab of Prime Rib," and that was by Ronald J. Hansen and Mary Jo Pitzel. We're approximately 32 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 6, 2025. Continuing on with Valley and State News, in some weather-related news, this next article is entitled, "Years of Severe Drought, Extreme Dryness Drive Arizona's Critical Wildfire Outlook." This is by Haley Evans. The state can expect a critical fire season due to months of extreme short-term drought, Arizona Department of Forestry and Fire Management officials told Governor Katie Hobbs during a briefing on March 31st. "This is one of the most critical years that we've seen in our career," said John Truitt, fire management officer for the Department of Forestry and Fire Management. "We're coming off several years of drought, and we're experiencing very extreme dryness in our vegetation this year." Wildfires tend to pick up in March, with peak risk in April, May, and June as temperatures rise, humidity drops, and winds blow. Most of the state has faced extreme short-term drought since the end of the 2024 monsoon season. Phoenix had its second longest dry spell on record, with 159 consecutive days without measurable rain between August 22, 2024 and January 29, 2025. Snowpack across the high country was well below average. Flagstaff Airport recorded 46.8 inches of snow since July 1, 2024, compared to an 83.7 inch average during the same time frame. With a three-decade drought, vegetation across the state is increasingly dry and ready to burn. Hobbs acknowledged Arizona's wildfire season has become year-round, but this year could be particularly dangerous. Arizona prepares for hot, dry fire outlook. As we head into the hotter months, obviously the risk is a lot greater, Hobbs said. The Department of Forestry and Fire Management is making sure the state is well prepared for another intense wildfire season. The department has treated over 23,000 acres across Arizona since July, removing vegetation that fuels wildfires, and has a goal to treat 30,000 acres by the end of the fiscal year. The state also joined the Great Plains Interstate Fire Compact in 2024, allowing Arizona to access fire prevention, preparedness, and suppression resources from other participating states. Truitt predicts any fire start could turn into a large event and stress the state's resources. Despite the extreme risk, local and federal agencies are working to reduce fuel loads and fire risk while fighting fires quickly and efficiently when they inevitably start. With drought and heat conditions across much of the country, natural resources will be strained. Truitt said the department will be cautious in how it balances aiding partners across the West while maintaining staffing in Arizona, especially if there are multiple fires burning at once across the state. Despite DOGE funding cuts and widespread layoffs across agencies like the U.S. Forest Service, Truitt says resource availability and staffing to address fire risk have not been affected. Fire managers are almost fully staffed, with seasonal firefighters joining hotshot teams and fire engines. The department is on pace to have all its positions filled by the peak fire season. Both Hobbs and Truitt urged the public to educate themselves and minimize fire risk. In 2020, more than 80% of Arizona's fires were caused by people. A lot of our starts are human-caused, and those can be preventable. Just be cautious when you're out cleaning your properties, recreating and using towing chain, Truitt said. We just had a chain drag 20 miles and created 18 new fires, so that tells us the probability of ignition is way up. And that article is entitled, Years of Severe Drought, Extreme Dryness Drive Arizona's Critical Wildfire Outlook. And that was by Haley Evans. Another weather article by Haley Evans is called, As Phoenix Warms Up, the Weather Service Has a Warning for Pet Owners. As temperatures climb in the valley, the National Weather Service Phoenix is reminding pet owners to take extra precautions to keep their animals safe from the heat. The Weather Service issued a heat safety warning, urging residents to avoid leaving pets outdoors for extended periods and ensure they have access to plenty of water. One of the biggest dangers? Hot cars. Even a few minutes inside a parked vehicle can be deadly for animals, even when cracking the windows. Heat stroke can set in within 15 minutes, putting pets in serious danger. Pet owners should also be mindful of scorching pavement. Asphalt and concrete absorb heat and can cause painful burns on dogs' paws. A simple rule of thumb is if the ground is too hot for your hand or bare feet, it's too hot for your pet. Walking your dog in the early morning or late evening when surfaces are cooler can help keep your pet safe. For more heat safety tips, visit weather.gov/heat. And that article is entitled, As Phoenix Warms Up, the Weather Service Has a Warning for Pet Owners. That was by Haley Evans. Our next article is entitled, Glendale Community College Turns 60 as First Bachelor's Students Near Graduation. This is by Helen Rummel. William Teske remembers the rain coming down on the very first day he saw the Glendale Community College campus. It was in 1966. Towering palm trees surrounded the mall at the center of the college, having been moved from the original ranch that once sat on the property. Faculty had helped replant the trees for the latest school in the Maricopa County Community College District. Teske said he hadn't known for several months that he had become one of the first students to attend GCC. Now 79, the alum returned to campus to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the first college built in the West Valley. GCC President Tiffany Hernandez described the early plans for the school in the 1960s when the original property at 59th and Olive Avenues was home to acres of farmland. But what they saw, instead of the corn stalks in front of them, was a bustling college campus filled with eager students and passionate faculty and staff, Hernandez said. Glendale Community College has grown to be part of the solution. Hernandez said she was excited to see where the college is today, with students, faculty, and community members coming out to celebrate on April 1st with food, balloons, and prizes. It will be a notable year for the school, with its first bachelor's students graduating later this spring. The school also noted the upcoming expansion of its Gaucho Security Operations Center, named after the school's mascot. The program offers paid internships to cybersecurity students who go on to work for different municipalities in partnership with the Arizona Department of Homeland Security. Due to its success, the basis of the program created by GCC will be replicated in areas across the state, said Ryan Murray of the AZDHS. Unfortunately, our adversaries are better equipped, better resourced, better funded, and better supported than we are, Murray said. But you guys are changing this. You're part of the solution. Hernandez said the school has also continued to focus on access and affordability, with price tags per credit hour coming out to roughly $100 to $150 for Maricopa County residents. The college is also growing with a nearly 5% enrollment jump from last year, she said. We've really shown that we have the services and support to make sure students are successful and they stay in classes, Hernandez said. Alums praised GCC for opening higher education pathways. Teske said he had few other options to turn to when he was looking for a school to attend in the 1960s. His test scores were not high enough to attend other nearby colleges at the time. Without GCC, he said, the journey toward higher education would have been more difficult. I really have to give them credit where credit is due, Teske said. He later graduated with an associate's degree in 1967, the inaugural class for the school's new campus. Teske opted not to come to the ceremony, a choice he said he now regrets. He continues to return to the campus for reunions and alumni events when he can. Tanisha Baca said she was preparing for her first day at GCC in 2001 as she sat in a Denny's with a plate of pancakes. And let me tell you, there were a lot of dreams hovering over the stack of pancakes that I devoured that morning, Baca said. At the time, Baca had hopes of becoming the first in her family to graduate from college. Today, she said she has exceeded that goal, going on to receive a master's degree and become a resident faculty member in GCC's communication department. She said her passion is helping her students find purpose in their studies, going on to teach in the same classroom she was once a student in. Because of GCC, I have the opportunity to do that every day for the rest of my life, and I'm truly thankful for that. And that article is entitled, Glendale Community College Turns 60 as First Bachelor's Students Near Graduation. And that was by Helen Rummel. In our remaining time in this first hour of the Arizona Republic, we're going to move on now to national and world news with articles from USA Today. We have two front page articles, one on the anti-Trump rallies that occurred yesterday, and the second on the Gaza war. We'll begin with the anti-Trump rallies span U.S. is the title of the first article. The subtitle is First Major Opposition Demonstration Held Since Return to Office. This is by Jonathan Landay, Nathan Lane, and Tim Reed. Thousands of protesters gathered in Washington, D.C. and across the U.S. on Saturday, part of some 1,200 demonstrations that were expected to form the largest single day of protest against President Donald Trump and his billionaire ally Elon Musk since they launched a rapid-fire effort to overhaul the government and expand presidential authority. People streamed onto the expanse of grass surrounding the Washington Monument under gloomy skies and light rain. Organizers told Reuters that more than 20,000 people were expected to attend a rally at the National Mall. Some 150 activist groups had signed up to participate, according to the event's website. Protests were planned in all 50 states plus Canada and Mexico. Terry Klein, a retired biomedical scientist from Princeton, New Jersey, was among those who gathered by the stage beneath the Washington Monument. She said she drove down to attend the rally to protest Trump's policies on everything from immigration to the Doge stuff to the tariffs this week to education. I mean, our whole country is under attack, all of our institutions, all the things that make America what it is. The crowd around the memorial continued to build throughout the day. Some carried Ukrainian flags, and others wore Palestinian keffiyeh scarves and carried Free Palestine signs, while Democrats from the U.S. House blasted Trump's policies on the stage. Wayne Hoffman, age 73, a retired money manager from West Cape May, New Jersey, said he was concerned about Trump's economic policies, including his widespread use of tariffs. "It's going to cost the farmers in the red states. It's going to cost people their jobs, certainly their 401ks. People have lost tens of thousands of dollars," Hoffman said. Kyle, a 20-year-old intern from Ohio, was a lone Trump supporter, sporting a Make America Great Again hat and walking the fringe of the Washington, D.C. rally while engaging protesters in debate. "Most people aren't too hostile. A few people cuss," said Kyle, who declined to give his last name. Trump, who shook financial markets and upset nations around the world with a raft of trade tariffs this past week, spent the day in Florida playing a round of golf at his club in Jupiter before returning to his Mar-a-Lago compound in the afternoon. Some 4 miles from Mar-a-Lago in West Palm Beach, more than 400 demonstrators gathered on a sunny day in protest. Drivers honked their horns in support of the pastel and khaki-clad demonstrators as they passed by. "Markets tank, Trump golfs," read one sign. At another protest in Stamford, Connecticut, Sue Ann Friedman, age 84, brought a bright pink handmade sign objecting to the administration's moves to cut funding for medical research. "I thought my marching days were over, and then we get somebody like Musk and Trump," Friedman said. Doge under fire. With Trump's blessing, Musk's Department of Government Efficiency team has scythed through the U.S. government, eliminating more than 200,000 jobs from the 2.3 million federal workforce. At times, the effort has been haphazard and forced the recall of needed specialists. On Friday, the Internal Revenue Service began laying off more than 20,000 workers, as much as 25% of its ranks. Several hundred people gathered outside the headquarters of the Social Security Administration, a top Doge target, near Baltimore to protest against cuts to the agency, which delivers benefits to the elderly and disabled. Linda Falcao, who turned 65 in 2 months, told the crowd she had been paying into the Social Security fund since the age of 16. "I'm terrified, I'm angry, I'm pissed, I'm bewildered this could happen in the United States," she said. "I do love America and I'm heartbroken. I need my money. I want my money. I want my benefits." The crowd chanted, "It's our money." White House Assistant Press Secretary Liz Houston disputed the protesters' charge that Trump aimed to cut Social Security and Medicaid. "President Trump's position is clear. He will always protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid for eligible beneficiaries." Meanwhile, the Democrats' stance is giving Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare benefits to illegal aliens, which will bankrupt these programs and crush American seniors, Houston said in an email. Much of Trump's agenda has been restrained by lawsuits contending he has overstepped his authority with attempts to fire civil servants, deport immigrants, and reverse transgender rights. And that article was entitled "Anti-Trump Rallies Span U.S." That was by Jonathan Landay, Nathan Lane, and Tim Reed. Our next front page article from USA Today is entitled "Paramedic Says Israelis Fired on Emergency Vehicles," with the subtitle "Red Cross UN Accused Troops of Killing Workers." This is by Nadal Al-Maghrabi. A Palestinian paramedic who was present at an incident in which 15 of his colleagues were killed in southern Gaza last month said he saw Israeli troops firing at emergency vehicles that he later saw stained with blood. after several days of uncertainty on the whereabouts of the paramedics, Red Crescent and UN officials found the bodies of the 15 emergency aid workers buried in a mass grave in southern Gaza, accusing Israeli forces of killing them. Another worker is still missing. Munther Abed, a volunteer for the Palestinian Red Crescent, said he was responding to a call with two colleagues near Rafah in the south of the Gaza Strip on March 23rd when he was detained by the Israeli soldiers shortly before they opened fire on other emergency vehicles. He said he had not been able to see exactly what happened when the soldiers opened fire, but his account corresponds with assertions by officials from the Palestinian Red Crescent and the United Nations that the emergency workers from the Red Cross, Red Crescent, UN, and Palestinian Civil Emergency Services were targeted by Israeli troops. The Israeli military has opened an investigation into the incident, which by its account occurred when unmarked vehicles approached an Israeli position in the dark without lights or special markings and without previous coordinations. Factors, it said, had made the vehicle's advance appear suspicious. The military said the soldiers who opened fire had killed a number of Hamas and Islamic Jihad militants who were traveling in vehicles marked with the Red Crescent signs. The Palestinian Red Crescent describes Abed as the lone survivor of the incident, with the fate of the missing paramedics still unclear. Abed said he and colleagues had received a call to go out to help wounded people at around dawn following an airstrike in the Al-Hashishin area in Rafah, close to the border in Egypt. "We moved right away. It was me and two other colleagues. As soon as we arrived there, we came under fire and they detained us," he told Reuters by phone from his house in Khan Yunis, referring to shooting by Israeli soldiers. After he was detained, he said he lost sight of his two colleagues. As he was standing near the soldiers, he said he saw other emergency vehicles approaching the Israeli soldiers' position. "I could see the vehicle of the civil emergency. The soldiers began shooting at the vehicles. They fired heavily," he said. "It was dark and I couldn't see what happened to the people there, but the soldiers, fired heavily. They asked me to duck down and they were firing heavily. I felt as if the bullets were hitting me personally." On Saturday, the Red Crescent published a video obtained from the cell phone of a paramedic found buried in the mass grave. Filmed from inside a moving vehicle, it appears to show a clearly marked convoy of ambulances and a fire truck driving at dawn with their red lights flashing. After they stopped by a vehicle that had veered off the road, two rescue workers and another man can be seen before a volley of gunshots is heard. Reuters was able to verify the location of the video near the Tal al-Seltan area west of Rafah. The Israeli military said in a response to a request for comment about the video that the event on March 23rd was under thorough examination. All claims, including the documentation circulating about the incident, will be thoroughly and deeply examined to understand the sequence of events and the handling of the situation, it said. Blood on the vehicles. It was only after daybreak that Abed, who remained held at the location where he was initially detained, was able to get a clearer picture of what had happened. "With the first light of the day, things became clearer. I saw the vehicles of the civil emergency in the Red Crescent. The doors of all the vehicles were open and there was blood on the vehicles," he said. He said he saw a bulldozer dig four holes in the sandy ground before crushing the wrecked vehicles and burying them. "At that time, I had no clue about the fate of my colleagues," he said. Abed said he was held in detention by Israeli forces for about 15 hours, during which time he was interrogated and beaten. He said he saw the aid worker who is still missing, detained by Israeli soldiers. Eventually, he said the soldiers made some checks on him before they decided to release him. Nabal Farshak, spokesperson for the Palestinian Red Crescent, confirmed that Abed was working for the organization as a volunteer and was in Rafah that day with the mission. That article is entitled "Paramedic Says Israelis Fired on Emergency Vehicles," and that was by Nadal Al-Megrabi. Now, our last article in this first hour is entitled "Zelensky Disappointed with U.S. Embassy Reaction to Missile Strike." This is by Reuters staff. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Saturday expressed disappointment in the U.S. Embassy's response to a Russian missile strike that killed at least 19 people, including 9 children, in Zelensky's hometown of Kryvyi Rih. Zelensky, who has been cautious about openly criticizing Washington since an uneasy White House meeting with President Donald Trump in February, wrote on social media site X that several embassies in Kyiv had condemned Friday's attack and singled out Russia for carrying it out. He noted that the message from the U.S. embassy made no reference to Russia in condemning the attack. Later, in his nightly video address, Zelensky praised those who speak the truth clearly and directly about the attack. U.S. Ambassador Bridget Brink, writing on X about the strike, said, "Horrified that tonight a ballistic missile struck near a playground and restaurant in Kryvyi Rih. More than 50 people injured and 16 killed, including 6 children. This is why the war must end." Russia's defense ministry claimed it targeted a military gathering in Kryvyi Rih, a statement that Ukrainian military denounced as disinformation. Energy attacks. Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry said on Saturday Ukraine had increased its attacks on Russian energy infrastructure, hitting targets 14 times in the last 24 hours, despite a U.S. brokered moratorium, a charge Ukraine's military called fake and disinformation. In a statement published on Telegram, the ministry said Ukraine multiplied the number of unilateral attacks using drones and artillery shells on the energy infrastructure of Russian regions. It said the strikes had caused damage in Russia's Bryansk, Belgorod, Smolensk, Lipetsk, and Voronezh regions, as well as the Ukrainian regions of Luhansk and Kherson, parts of which Russia controls. And that article is entitled "Zelensky Disappointed with U.S. Embassy Reaction to Missile Strike," and that was by Reuters staff. And this concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 6th, 2025. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get it on our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.